I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there and welcome to the Stock Club podcast, coming to you from the top floor of my Wall Street HQ here in Dublin, Ireland. I'm James, and with me this week is my Wall Street co-founder and chief investor, Emmett Savage, and our head analyst, Rory Caron. In this episode, we're asking if the next recession is coming in 2020, why Ericsson is our favourite 5G stock, and picking the two stocks we'd like to add to our market-beating shortlist in 2020. So guys, welcome to the first podcast, 2020. First podcast of the new decade. Did you have a nice break?
No.
Starting the year off on a good foot, Rory, I like it.
It was supposed to be a lovely break. It didn't turn out that way.
Do you want to elaborate?
You have to elaborate.
Okay, yeah, well, I went to Morocco.
Nice.
It was very hard to get a drink, but it was very easy to get food poisoning. So, that was my break. So,
right, say no more.
Emmett, I hope your break was a little bit nicer than
that. It was, yeah, it was far more traditional than ours, sitting at home, eating too much and watching TV.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, my Anthony Bourdain-esque adventurism got the best of me, I think. Like, my girlfriend was there being like, "Ooh, don't know about that." And I was like, "Come on, it'd be grand." Yeah. The locals are eating it. Should be fine.
So, had it been perfect, what would you grade Moroccan food out of 10, if 10 is the best you've ever had?
I was genuinely disappointed. I really do like my food, and I was really expecting a lot, and I found it just not to be up there. You kind of gave me a warning. You've been living in the
Middle East. Yeah, this is just a personal preference. I wouldn't be crazy on Middle Eastern food personally, but I never got food poisoning from it though either, so I think your opinion would be skewed a bit.
Was it mostly lamb-based?
Very lamb-based.
Right.
Very tagine-based.
Yeah.
That's kind of their whole thing.
Right.
I kind of thought there'd be a bit more...
Variety.
Variety going around, but... Yeah, look, considering I was poisoned, I won't.
Solid one.
Yeah, that's the asterisk beside my fucking food. If that hadn't happened, I'm sure it'd be higher.
Yeah.
So, first podcast of 2020, and I think it's probably fair to say already this year the news hasn't been great on a kind of a global level. The US-China trade war is still kind of rolling on. There's been rising tensions in the Middle East between the US and Iraq and Iran, and there's been more political and social instability in places like the UK and Hong Kong. And then that doesn't even take into account, Emmett, that we're moving into a US election year this year, which, you know, is typically a kind of an unstable and volatile time. So, you know, as an investor sitting here at the start of 2020, should we be worried or should we be concerned moving into this year?
So the 2010s ended as the only decade since at least 1850 without entering or experiencing one day of recession.
Wow.
So that's, you know, when you look at where we've just come from since 2010, I think the world is awaiting some kind of downturn.
Yeah.
Whatever label that downturn gets remains to be seen. Recession, correction, depression.
Yeah.
Or any of the other labels you can give a downturn. But it has been the longest dry spell. It's been the longest bull market. Or at least it's been the first decade where there hasn't been a downturn. So I think the question about the election is really, if I can paraphrase it, like, when might one expect the next downturn?
Yeah, because it's always coming. And I think that's something people forget.
It's always coming.
That, like, that's one of the biggest things you have to make peace with as an investor is that a downturn is coming. It's just a matter of when and by how much.
And it's not to be feared, actually. I really believe downturns, if you are fortunate enough to be in the springtime or summer of your life, there's something to be looked forward to, because the great businesses that we three talk about and analyze are suddenly going on sale. And so it's changing your mindset entirely. But I suspect, like, I do think that the year ahead, 2020, is going to be one of volatility. There's going to be a lot of, I suppose, pent-up expectations that kind of manifest themselves in shares going up and down on the most minor of news. But I'm of the mind, and really this is crystal ball stuff, so it doesn't really matter, but the next downturn won't happen until 2021.
Okay.
And there's two reasons why I believe that's the case. And the first is that the US economy has entered a recession only once, or only one time during the fourth year of a presidential cycle.
Okay.
However, 9 of the 14 recessions have occurred after an election.
Okay.
So the first piece of data is, if you look at all the recessions to date, the vast majority of them began the year after presidential elections.
Yeah, so which would be 2021 in
correct.
Our case.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the second reason is that that old yield curve that we discussed in not too far past, we had the US yield curve historically inverts, as we spoke about, on average 22 months before a recession begins.
Mm.
And then it steepens, and it's already kind of inverted.
Yeah.
So if you look at the yield curve, which is a very boring curve with a lot of data about returns and bond yields, it's just started to invert. So it indicates that something not altogether good is coming, but not immediately.
It's okay.
They're the two main reasons that I believe that 2020 will be one of kind of trepidation, and it will manifest, as I said, in volatility. And 2021, if a downturn hasn't occurred, I'd be of the mind that, you know, let's ready ourselves for some bargains.
So as the most experienced investor in the room and oldest, if you don't mind me saying so, you've probably been through one or two recessions, definitely the 2008 one and
I
think the .com as well.
For sure.
And kind of, can you talk a little bit about, you know, how, you know, it's all well and good kind of talking before the fact and, you know, preparing yourself. But, you know, when you're seeing your stocks plummet like that, What is it like, and how do you
It's horrible. I mean, yeah, so I have invested in 2 out of the 3 50% downturns.
Yeah.
So I've seen it twice. The first one, I lost my shirt, which was probably a podcast on its own right. But and the second, I was ready, not because I expected it, but because I knew the behaviors to expect from myself. And, you know, when you read about disaster management, you're ready a room or a house or a plane full of people as to what to do if a disaster strikes.
Yeah.
But the reality is, when a disaster strikes, very often you'll forget what you've been told. Like first aiders so often forget what they so diligently were trained in in the disasters, and pedestrian first aiders, not professionals. So the fact is, when a market turns down and you look at your brokerage account and everything is red, has gone down below what you paid, it's really uncomfortable. You question everything you've done, every decision you've made. You question even becoming an investor in the first place. And if you can absolutely double down and cool down and remember that you loved these businesses. Rory has repeatedly said over the last couple of years of us doing podcasts, you know, well, if you liked it at 50, you should like it at 40. And, you know, that is the truth of it.
Yeah.
Like, we look at businesses because we believe their very long-term perspective is something that is going to be, that horizon of that business is going to be way, way more attractive than it is today. And yeah, downturns occur. And I did find in the second 50% downturn in 2008, I actually was enjoying it. Do you ever hear that expression, you know, if you have a fight with a pig and you're rolling around in mud and you're just having a roll around punching a pig, it comes a point where you realise the pig's enjoying it? Well...
What?
Well, when I was in the first fight with my own mentality in the year 2000, I was in pain. In the second, in 2008, I was enjoying the downturn. I loved seeing these. That's where the world was actually curling in pain and saying, what the heck is happening? I was like the pig having a fight in mud. I was kind of enjoying it.
So moving on to some more recent news then. So we're already a few days into 2020, but one of the stocks from our showroom has been acquired. The Habit Burger Grill, it was announced on Monday, is being bought by Yum Brands. That's the parent company of such fast food giants as KFC and Taco Bell. The deal is worth about $375 million, about $14 per Habit share. Rory, what do you think about this?
I'm going to start by giving a pitch to a TV show that I just started watching on Netflix. I don't know if you guys have seen it yet. It's called Million Dollar Menu.
No.
It's a BBC production. I hadn't seen it when it was originally on the BBC, but it's and it probably won't be on Netflix for US customers. So I think it's an Irish UK thing. But
yeah,
it's essentially like the Dragon's Den for new restaurant concepts.
Oh wow!
It's quite an interesting thing. Like they have new restaurateurs, or like people usually have kind of food stalls or even like very small pop-up restaurants, pitch a new concept to a bunch of restaurant investors. And then they go and they have the food and they see how service goes. And then they decide whether they want to invest in the business to try and make it kind of
I love that
big
idea.
National brand.
Okay.
And I thought it was like some of the insights you get from these, like when we look at restaurants, we look at a lot of things like same store sales and, you know, profitability margins and all this kind of thing. But you got, there was some very kind of, I suppose when a company's that small, there's a lot more finicky things to think about. Like, for example, do you need a proper chef there every day? Because that's a cost increase. Or is your main product going to fluctuate in price quite a lot? So, for example, people love pasta restaurants because they're, you know, the price of pasta is going to be the price of pasta, pretty much flour and water.
Sure, yeah.
Whereas things like chicken prices fluctuate up and down quite a lot, as does beef stock. So that kind of thing was quite an insightful kind of look into what makes a successful restaurant from a very small startup stage to becoming a profitable enterprise over the long term.
Yeah.
So I thought anyone who is interested in that kind of stuff, I'd highly recommend that show.
Definitely. As you were speaking, I've just added to my Netflix list here, Million Pound Menu.
Million Pound Menu, yeah. There's only a couple of episodes, so I hope they do more of them and they pump out more.
And we've seen here locally restaurants that we particularly liked once-offs, and as they started to scale and expand, they lost that sparkle of magic, the flavour, the food, the quality. It just somehow, like, you could just perceive a change once they started to spread their wings.
Yeah, I also think there's huge, like there's such an appetite now for new concepts and new ideas. Yeah. People are getting a bit sick. I mean, burgers will always be there, but yes, like, I think people are looking for something a bit fresh and unique.
That's right.
Even just an experience. The word Instagrammable comes up an awful lot in that show.
Really?
Yeah, they're like, the investors really want food that people are going to take photos of and post on their Instagram. That's their one of their big things they look for. But I digress. Let's talk about The Habit. So the Habit was a chain of around 260 burger joints over in the West Coast of America. We've had them in the app for just over 2 years. I think we had them at like $15, $30 or something. So this acquisition is going to come down as a loss for us. It's unfortunate, but look, it happens. Bought out by Yum Brands for $375 million. Yum Brands are a $31 billion company. So this is very, very small for them. But I did an insight about them during the week, and I thought, you know, when we looked at The Habit originally, what we were trying to kind of figure out was one thing. There was one real big question in our head, which was that there's a very similar business, not based on the East Coast rather than the West Coast, which is also publicly traded, which gets an awful lot more airtime, I would say, in the financial world, and that was Shake Shack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Shake Shack was valued at like six times what The Habit is, even though they have pretty much the same amount of locations, make pretty much around the same revenue. Now, Shake Shack, in fairness, was a slightly bit more profitable company and was growing revenue slightly faster, but like the difference in the valuation was just insane.
So
the starting thought process was something's gone wrong here. Either the Shake Shack is massively overvalued or the Habit Burger and Grill is massively undervalued, and it's probably a bit of both. And part of the investment thesis was we reckon this is going to correct itself over the course of a couple of years.
Yeah.
And it was quite volatile stock. It went up and down a lot. But in the end, we're being bought out now, and we'll never figure out whether it was truly undervalued. But just some of the numbers that we found with the Shake Shack, and this is only recent now. This is just from when the acquisition happened. They basically have the exact same amount of restaurants. Each Habit location is currently valued around $1.4 million, whereas each Shake Shack is valued at $8.6
million. Wow.
So, throw another company for comparison. Each Chipotle is valued at $9.4 million. So, I mean, there's such a difference in valuation there, isn't there? Like, you really can't get into your head why. Yeah. I kind of had to think about it, and there's two things I think that we kind of didn't take into account, which maybe we should have taken into account. Which is one: the Shake Shack has a really good founding story. Do you know the founding story of Shake Shack?
No, actually, I know the Habit's founding story, but I'd be keen to hear the Shake Shack.
Shake Shack. So the guy, Danny Mayer, starts a basic hot dog cart, essentially in Madison Square Park, becomes really popular, queues around the corner, and then just started slowly building into restaurants. And like, he only started 15 years ago. Now it's
But that's a little like the Habit. The Habit was a burger truck.
Burger truck, yeah.
Yeah.
But a long time, much longer ago, wasn't it?
It was
in the 60s or something.
That's right, that is true. Yeah.
So I feel like the Shake Shack had a better founding story, which is really important. If you ever read The Four, the Scott Galloway book, he talks about how important founding stories are for stock price appreciation, because people buy into them and they get repeated ad nauseum.
Yeah.
And it gives people a sense of what they're buying into a bit more than if you have a kind of boring,
and nameless. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, most Shake Shacks, or like if you Google Shake Shack New York, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
They're absolutely everywhere, including on Broadway, in the heart of the financial district.
Yeah.
And if you have all the bankers in New York walking by queues going out the door of Shake Shack every day, that is going to have an impact on how they start valuing companies, whether they wanted to or not.
Yeah.
I love that theory.
That repetitive trigger will definitely make you think differently about something. Like we talk about it all the time. If you see a business that people are going to all the time that they love, you do start thinking of it in much more positive terms, even if you particularly might not like the product or something
That.
So yeah, so those are two things that I think may have contributed to that. Look, the deal is done now.
Yeah.
Is Shake Shack overvalued though, maybe?
But you know, I probably spin off of the point you made where like having a Shake Shack on Broadway or Bryant Park or whatever is there for all to be seen. I wonder if the geography of the habit being a West Coast brand somewhat valued it less. You know, it's the extreme example. Like you wouldn't see a habit within, I think, like probably 3,000 miles of the middle of New York City. So I'd say that figured as well. I really felt the habit was sold for a bargain.
It was, especially because they just kicked off a big franchise plan. Things were opening up in China, which seemed to be going quite well. They were talking about opening Cambodia. There was some demand for it there.
Yeah.
But they were like, they were just on the cusp of kind of trying the new thing.
And all these best burger awards. I mean, apparently the burgers were delicious.
Apparently. They did. The management team did seem very sluggish, though. Did you not find that? Like, it just, every year it seemed to be like, oh, yeah, we said we'd do that last year. But we'll do it this year. Definitely this year.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't really seem to be as, I don't want to say ambitious, but they just didn't have the kind of go out and do it attitude other chains seem to do.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so look, we're locking a loss for that. That's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. Yeah. Is it the 12th or 13th stock acquired from our list?
Losing track now.
Yeah.
I think it's around 13. What did we...
It's over 10.
No, Tiffany was 12 and I think was 13,
So that's the Habit Burger Grill being acquired by Yum Brands. We're going to move on now to the company we never talk about. Rory, we're talking about another company in our showroom, FedEx.
Yeah, so start this off by talking about something we talk about in here quite a lot, which is the pick and shovel play. And for investors who don't know what that is, it's when there's a trend going on, usually quite an explosive one, but it might be too high risk for you to go directly into that. But what you can do is you can invest in companies that, through their technology or through the services they provide, benefit from the growth in the trend.
Okay.
The name itself, Pick and Shovel Play, comes from the gold rush in California, where all these speculators were going off trying to find gold in the mountains. But the companies that really did well were the guys selling the picks and shovels.
It
didn't matter to them whether anyone found gold. As long as people were trying, that was good enough for them. So a couple of good examples of pick and shovel plays. Cryptocurrency was the big mania a couple of years ago. A lot of people bought Bitcoin. A lot of people lost a lot of money. Whereas there was a couple of companies, and NVIDIA is one that's kind of sticks out, which because of their graphic chips being used in the process of mining Bitcoin, did very well. Now, they also had a bit of a sell-off when cryptocurrencies collapsed because people were selling. There became a third market for the graphics chips when companies were selling them off and so forth. Marijuana one I was looking at as well, a pick and shovel play for marijuana, and Scott's Miracle-Gro might be an interesting one.
I know is that a product in America?
Yeah, Scott's Miracle-Gro is it's a like 40-year-old company that sells mostly kind of fertilizer and things like that, but they have a very small hydroponics business, which if they ever legalize marijuana in the US, which it looks like they will, they have great route to capturing big market share.
They've got
huge thanks for that. So that was another example of pick and shovel play. And like FedEx is definitely a pick and shovel play.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
we're talking about e-commerce being the future. And you would think, therefore, that shipping logistics was going to be a major player in that. And there's only three big worldwide shipping logistics businesses. So pick the one you think is best run, invest in that, or invest in all three, and you're bound to do well. And that's not been the case at all. Like UPS and FedEx have both been pretty much flat since we added.
So are Amazon going to destroy FedEx? It's the kind of the giant question.
They might destroy... Well, you see, they can't fully destroy FedEx because other retailers aren't going to give Amazon their business.
Yeah,
that's true.
Nor their customer
data. Nor their logistics, of course. Yeah.
So they'll have to go to someone. Yeah. They won't go to Amazon anyway, even if they are offering something a bit cheaper and better.
Yeah.
But some looking back on FedEx, there's been a couple of things that have just, like when you look at them, you just go, oh yeah, I can see why that stock's not performing very well now.
Mm.
They're a $42 billion business, operate pretty much all over the world. They generate revenue of about $70 billion last year, so it's a big, massive cash generator, but unfortunately it's a very low margin business. And there's some elements of it that are more profitable, but on a mixed gross margin basis, which is that first line of profitability that you look for, they're only keeping about 20 cents of every dollar, which doesn't give you an awful lot of room to maneuver further down the profit and income, the income statement. And it's been a business that's been just very slowly in decline as well. Like, it, not necessarily in terms of revenue. Revenue continues to grow, but in terms of operating income, eventual profit. Like in 2018, the business generated net income of $4.5 billion from $65 million in revenue. Last year, they only brought in $500 million,
okay,
and that was off a bigger revenue base. Now that's, they've been investing heavily in the business, and they bought out a European operator called TNT a couple of years ago, which has been a big drag on investment money. Mm-hmm. Now they really have to had pumped in a lot of money into that. But I'm kind of thinking that it may be at a good point now where it could become a kind of value buy. And it's gotten to the point now where it looks like something that Warren Buffett would buy, and a couple of people have said, you know, he is big into shipping logistics companies, that it is a buyer candidate for him, who's sitting on his
a lot of money.
I think $138 billion was the last one I read. So in that sense, like, it's a company that has been subject to pretty much every potential headwind you can think of, like recession going to hurt them, trade war going to hurt them,
Amazon
going to hurt them. There's so many things you could say are bad about this. I think that could be starting to get priced in a bit.
Okay.
So yeah, it's been nearly totally flat for us in five years. It's become a bit more interesting at the moment, I think.
I have three fast FedEx facts that have absolutely no bearing whatsoever.
Go for it.
Are you ready for them?
Yeah, love it.
Wilson, the real Wilson, the volleyball from Castaway, was sold to a FedEx executive for $18,500, which to me sounds like a deal.
Are you going to tell your Wilson story?
The fact that Tom Hanks tweeted me and then everybody laughed at me.
Maybe we'll save that for another podcast.
Okay,
I think
well,
that deserves
well,
a podcast.
But anyway,
itself.
That was a goodbye to me, Wilson the volleyball, $18,500 to a FedEx exec. Second fact is, in 1994, a FedEx jet suffered a hijacking attempt by a disgruntled employee armed with loads of nasty weapons, and the captain flew upside down to prevent a takeover. That's pretty cool.
That's pretty.
Did you see that movie?
Flight.
Yeah, he did that. I mean, I thought that was a good one. And then the third fact is FedEx planes have anti-missile countermeasures, and they're the only commercial plane to carry this. And you can read all about that in the Northrop Grumman wiki page, because Northrop Grumman are anti-missile countermeasure extraordinaires. So you need to have a read about that. But yeah, they have anti-missile.
And what is an anti-missile countermeasure?
I think it's a missile that fires back at the first missile. If you see a missile coming at you, you've one that can intercept.
I thought you were going to tell the one about the casino.
Which one was that?
Am I getting that wrong? It was with Fred Smith, the CEO, who like literally they were down to their last million. The company was going to close down, and he flew off to Las Vegas.
Really?
And basically doubled down 10 times or something and saved the business.
You're kidding.
I'm just going to read. I just Googled that there, Rory, when you said that.
Call me up,
Smith, they were down to their last $5,000.
Oh,
and Smith flew to Las Vegas and played blackjack with the last of the company money and turned $5,000 into $27,000. Enough for the company to stay in operation for another week. So that's pretty impressive. So that is FedEx, the company we never talk about. Rory's actually written a Daily Insight about FedEx that you can read in my Wall Street app at the moment, as well as his thoughts on the habit being bought out and our January stock of the month, which is a really, really cool company. Let's move on now to Jargon Buster. So one question for this week's Jargon Buster. It comes from Gustavo through to my Wall Street app, and he asks, what are the advantages Ericsson has over the likes of Qualcomm and Skyworks in the 5G race? So Ericsson is one of the companies on the My Wall Street shortlist. So why kind of have we picked them above other companies involved in 5G?
To answer that, I think I'd like to just start by explaining a little bit about what 5G is and what it offers over 4G.
Yeah.
Because at this stage now, I think most of us consumers are kind of losing track.
Yeah.
We're just thinking, yeah, it's faster. But so, yeah, it is. And so if we compare 5G to 4G, it has 10 times the connection density. It has 10 times lower latency. It's 100 times the capacity, and it's about 1,000 times faster on data volume.
Yeah.
So definitely it is what most people expect. It just goes faster for more devices. And I rang a friend of mine last night who is an industry veteran, and he knows all about 5G, 4G and everything that preceded. And you know, trying to understand, I was curious, can 5G be done with a software upgrade? Mm. Like, is this something where you just send an update to all the server cabinets? And the answer very much is no. There's a lot of new antenna required, lots of ports, lots of new hardware. And then getting into the physics of it, there's new frequency bands and big loading, huge structural upgrades needed. And
so it's nearly false to say it's just an upgrade from 4G. It's nearly a new technology in itself.
Yes, it's definitely a new standard. And for us, the consumer, yeah, it's literally, I got a new 5G phone. But
yeah.
Behind that, the T-Mobiles and friends of the world have been investing hundreds of millions and billions of dollars in upgrading their network and effectively building a new network. So
yeah.
It is a very, very big project. It's not just a flick the switch there now, Paddy, and we'll switch on to 5G. So in the US in 2019, 4G accounted for 91% of all subscriptions, which is the highest share globally. And in the same year last year, 5G accounted for 1% of mobile subscriptions. And that makes sense. 5G isn't really out there yet. And it's expected that in 2025, so in 5 years from now, the number of subscriptions to 5G will be 74%.
Okay.
So it's not that 5G is going to be there this summer. Our next summer, it's slowly going to roll out. It's going to, and then demand will follow, if you like, the build it and they will come. Mm. So 5G will come out, and so too will handsets, and it'll eventually be part of our lives. It's estimated that in 2025, 5 years from now, there's going to be an estimated 2.6 billion 5G subscriptions globally. And 5G is going to impact a lot of industries, everything from drones, autonomous drones, robotics and manufacturing and self-driving cars, IoT. The movement we're about to see now, where machines effectively think for themselves, is going to be powered by 5G.
Okay.
So that's, I guess, the first explanation of what is 5G, and it's the Internet of Everything.
Yeah.
So the question that we got kind of was mixing oil and water, and what does Ericsson have over the likes of Qualcomm and Skyworks? And when we positioned Ericsson, we weren't saying that they really aren't competitors. Like, in speaking to my friend and then other friends of mine who are very well versed on the industry, I asked them all to pitch to me what stock they believed would do best as a result of the rollout of 5G.
Okay.
And these, the crew that I spoke to all individually, so there's no groupthink, I didn't bias in any way. I simply asked, of all the companies you know, which ones will most benefit from 5G?
Yeah.
And two of the five experts I spoke to independently said Ericsson. And for all the reasons that we spoke about before, there's a massive capital outlay for new infrastructure. Huawei was one of, someone else said Huawei, but we collectively acknowledged that the smoke without fire thing that Huawei had, it will take a long time to go away.
Yeah, there's a bit of extra baggage with Huawei.
Yeah, there is. And I have it on good account that Huawei's technology is superior.
Mm.
Like, they're seemingly, I'm told, way, way ahead of anyone else, but they have this shroud of
political kind of
darkness by exactly. So Huawei is there, and besides, we can't buy shares in Huawei. They're not listed on a US exchange. Ericsson was the choice of two of my other friends, and then Cellnex was a name I never heard, and it's a Barcelona based business that are effectively the European American Tower, who are in kind of acquisition mode, buying up towers all over Europe and building out effectively an infrastructure network for all the networks to tag onto. I still believe that American Tower offers us the best way to gain exposure to this massive infrastructure rollout, because as I said, new antenna are required, and these antenna, they don't hang off the clouds. Yeah. They got to go somewhere. Yeah. And then existing towers are where people want antenna. No one wants, or most people don't want to see new antenna being thrown up outside their window. So I think 5G is a far bigger project than people might think. You know, it's a multi-billion-dollar, multi-year rollout of new technology, and there will be many, many businesses that are born from this technology. But at the core, the delivery machine of 5G is Ericsson and friends. And that's why at the time we chose Ericsson. And I still believe that while Ericsson is probably flat or even slightly down since we added it to our shortlist of great businesses, its day in the sun is yet to come as far as I'm concerned. I also would say, just while I'm on a roll, that Nokia, I think, has lost its way somewhat.
Okay.
And they, for a bunch of strategic reasons, kind of lost their way. But Ericsson have really done very well at acquiring key parts of the business. So to the question from our listener, it's complex. I mean, we could argue that some small drone manufacturer, autonomous drones, will be a big winner from 5G. They will, but really it's how far out from the absolute center of the technology stack are you going, and Ericsson sit in the absolute middle of it.
Okay, cool. Hope that helped, Gustavo. Right, we're going to do our elevator pitch now before we finish up. For this one, the first podcast of 2020, I asked you guys to pick the stock you think might be added to my Wall Street shortlist this year. I suppose this is made easier by the fact that it's the three of us that choose the stocks to go in, so you can't really be wrong. But looking at the year ahead, what stock are you kind of, that's not on in the My Wall Street app at the moment, what stock are you most excited about? Rory, I'll come to you first.
Yes, there's a stock I was looking at about 3 or 4 years ago now, and I did actually spend quite a lot of time on it, looked at it quite closely, and then I just kind of forgot about it. I ended up looking at it again there about a month or two ago, and it's been a huge run.
And I've been it's heartbreaking.
So heartbreaking.
Yeah.
The company is called RealPage.
RealPage, yeah.
Yeah, it's a software as a service company that serves basically anyone who rents out to tenants, and not necessarily individuals, but we're talking big sort of rental companies. And what they do is basically they give them everything you kind of need in terms of business analytics, marketing, accounting software, being able to fill the rooms, keeping track of who's paid their rent, keeping track of how much you're expected to make over the course of the next year. It's still a very small company, even though it's been on a big run. It's a $5.2 billion company. And some of the reasons I liked it originally, which are still the case, is that the founder CEO is still there after about 24 years. He still owns a huge stake in the company. I think something like 30% of the shares is still his. He runs it like a Swiss watch. The revenue goes up at about 13 to 15% every single quarter. And they're expected to break the 1 billion mark, maybe not this fiscal year, but definitely over the trailing 12 months.
Okay.
So yeah, it's a company I'm really interested in. I think they've got a niche in the market that they've really grabbed. There's 17 million units being served by them at the moment. And yeah, I'm just sad to see it's gone up so much.
Yeah.
It'll definitely be on the watch list for the next 12 months.
Okay, so that was the RealPage. Emmett, what company are you looking at coming into this year?
Yeah, Illumina is a stock I bought back in December 2003. And I had not the impetuousness of youth gotten the better of me. I wouldn't have dumped it. I sold it about a year or two later, and it's bet up 100-fold since, which kind of kills me. But Illumina, I think ILMN is its ticker, if I recall, is a business. It's in the business of gene chip arrays. So it allows scientific businesses to to unravel and to sequence, as it's known, the genes of a living organism to see what, in fact, the constituent parts are, which is obviously an extremely...
simple.
Yeah, exactly. It's a simple business. Anyway, the business has more cash than debt is because of its complexity and amazing return on equity. And I believe it's incredibly future relevant.
Yeah.
You know, we're in 2020 now. We still haven't really seen bespoke medication on a large scale. A lot of people have done 23andMe and Ancestry and for fun have seen their genes decoded, including myself, and that invariably went through an Illumina chip array. But I think the practical application of having your genes forensically analysed are going to grow in the years ahead, and I think that this is the clear leader in the area.
Okay, so one we'll be keeping an eye on. There is often a risk though investing in companies like that, Emmett. I know you've talked about before, like biotech companies, that they're extremely volatile.
Illumina is effectively a hardware and software company.
Okay.
It builds chips with software to analyse what they've looked at.
Okay.
So it is, but your point still valid. It's an inordinately complex business. Like, it's really complex. Even understanding what the heck they do is in its own right. I looked at the range of products there last night, and frankly, I was like a chicken looking into a welly. There was just no apps. I have all the farmyard analogies today.
Like a chicken. So with that, that's about it from this week's Stock Club. Don't forget about all the great new stuff in the My Wall Street app at the moment, and if there's anything you want us to discuss or explain on the next episode of Stock Club, make sure to get in touch with us on Twitter, that's at My Wall Street HQ, or email us at pod@mywallstreet, that's pod@mywallstreet.com. And please don't forget to subscribe to Stock Club. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a review for us on whatever podcasting platform you listen to us on. That's it from us here today. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy investing.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.